thank you. So, yeah, it's pretty hard to follow such a well-versed description of the recovery and response process for which Christine's coordinating. It's a really overwhelming process to see the community being supported by such a professional process and a comprehensive suite of support tools to help them back on their feet. I guess I've had the illustrious honour of reviewing or surveying a lot of bushfires in the past, and the community is really in many cases left to their own devices to work things out internally, but here we see a really solid, robust, comprehensive support network for them, which is really heartening. So there's not really a lot I can say on the response and recovery process beyond what Christine's highlighted, but what I can do today is provide a bit more context around this particular fire to promote a bit more thought and process around how we might continue on to build our communities in a more resilient fashion. So I brought a few small slides along to sort of place these fires in a context, and in an Australian context, I guess, is the most appropriate. These are current figures on the amounts of actual livable dwellings that we've lost since records were kept in 1939. What's particularly interesting is down here we have a bit of a hotspot where we are at the moment. Yet I've placed on this map the number of years or number of times burnt in the last 9 years. That's a colour scale, and there should be a few extra little purple patches down here for the Victorian fires, but I didn't have a chance to upgrade the map. But what's really interesting is the most active fire area in Australia is actually up here. And the losses up in this region are actually negligible. So what this really points a finger at is that it's not fire frequency that is driving our loss statistics. It's actually fire intensity and the intensity of fire weather. So the next map I've got here is actually a plot based on fire weather potential and fire weather and potential for infrequent extremes of fire weather. And this really paints a more consistent story with the last slide that highlights the issue or the drivers around what house loss really is. And what's really obvious in our statistics from all of our fire research in the past is that it's these extreme fire weather events that occur very infrequently that is the fundamental driver. In fact, over 50% of all the losses that have occurred in the past have occurred over an FSDI of 100, which is the sort of the typical off-the-scale fire event that we talk about, and this fire is certainly no exception. And I'd like to provide a bit of a personal context in that I really think the weather conditions that we saw in these Victorian fires isn't particularly extraordinary, and it's really the type of fire that I think we should need to focus on as a design fire for building and being resilient to in future events. And if you overlay the context of climate change and what our climate change models are suggesting, they're all pointing to the fact that we're going to see that type of fire weather intensity far more frequently than we have in our historic statistics, let alone the possibility of seeing even more extreme fire events in the future. And in fact, well over 90% of all of our house losses have occurred under fire weather conditions where we simply just can't stop the fire. Aerial suppression is not effective at beyond, say, an FSDI of 50 once the fire grows beyond a certain amount. And it's every time we have a fire weather event that goes well beyond that point, we almost invariably have house loss, and that's where all of our statistics are driven. So it really comes down to a urban design context and a community preparedness context, because that's the final sort of front at which we have to fight these fires. I guess another interesting context for fires like this, when we have these excursions into quite extreme infrequent weather, is that other weather contexts come into play. And what we found in surveying the houses post these fires is that we actually noted that well over 10% of the houses had really clear evidence of wind damage, where the structures were actually compromised through wind effects as well as being imposed by fire effects. And it really brings in an interesting context of saying, well, from a regulatory framework, we're relying on two regulatory platforms to both do their job to make sure we're performing well there. Now, a lot of these affected structures showed evidence of wind effect. That's not to say they weren't built to a particular standard. They might have not been built to any wind loading code at all, but nevertheless, that's an effect. And if we start to push this weather context even further into to higher level intensities, what's the likely play out of the of things like wind effect? So I wouldn't like to suggest that that as we slowly creep up in fire weather intensity, we get more and more loss. I tend to like to highlight the idea that we would, as we go up in fire weather intensity, we would hit some interesting thresholds that are going to see the statistics rocket up. So I guess the way a lot of our risk modelling work around the interface has played out is it really plays out to demonstrate the fact that it's the weakest link in a structure's design or its location that really is the fundamental driver. So that's not to say we can do many things, have fancy windows and shutters and whatnot, but if we haven't addressed the fundamental weak link, like an unprotected vent around the back of the house or a small detail that isn't addressed, then we really haven't managed the risk effectively in that urban design. And I'd like to also emphasise the fact that I think regulation is a really effective minimum standard setting process that really strikes at the small percentage of all our communities that wouldn't have otherwise adopted any risk mitigation strategies at all, and that the rest of the community that is willing and able should build on that minimum standard and create a risk exposure that's well beyond appropriate for their particular circumstance. What I've also really noticed is that we've got a whole suite of potential treatments for risk in our situation here. We've got building regulation, planning policy, community education, etc. But what I really see is that we really need to marry those three regions together in a unified framework to really start dealing with the issues of risk and risk mitigation. I could throw a small example in, like we can build our house to a really effective design standard for its particular distance from a bush, but that might be immediately adjacent to a house that isn't built to any particular standard at all. So your risk is actually governed by your neighbouring house's likelihood of survival in that scenario. Or in fact, you could build a fence straight up between those two houses, which modify the exposure of the house itself. So until we marry building regulation with planning policy, we've got problems with putting small incipient modifications into the landscape that could have a huge impact on risk. And the other angle is that community education, I think, is an absolute fundamental underpinning of this whole process, in that if the occupant of the house that adopts this very well-designed structure and is subject to this planning influence doesn't have a design manual or a user guide that says this is why your house was built this way, this is how you maintain it throughout its design life, then the first thing they may in fact do is inadvertently modify the house in a way that doesn't support those original intentions. But what I'm really happy with is the fact that a lot of the workshops that I've attended and that have been driven by Viva, etc., have really given me the confidence that the community are embracing the fundamental ideas of understanding risk, and they're accepting that responsibility to become risk aware, and that they're really taking it on as a personal goal to understand their own personal context and to take measures to reduce that. And I really hope that intent to embrace the risk and build resilience is going to persist sort of long after the memory of these fires fade. Thank you.